Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
In a great old religious song, whether it's a spiritual or something else, there is a balm in Gilead. One of the lines is, if you can pray like Peter, if you can preach like Paul, then go tell all your neighbors he died to save us all. Peter and Paul, to be sure, are great preachers at the very beginning of Christianity. And there have been great preachers all across history, not merely in the many divisions of Christianity, but surely in Islam. Indeed, clearly, Muhammad was a preacher, among other things. And there are great preachers, rabbis, that we can identify in the history of Judaism. And one of them would have been the Rabbi Hillel, for whom the Hillel Foundations all over the country on university campuses are named. Why am I going on about all of this? Because tonight, with Randall Balmer and Manya Brashear, we're going to talk about great and central quasi or fully charismatic figures in the pulpit or in the preacher's position, people who made a difference in religious life and made a difference to, in the way that religion very often acts upon the larger world and acts upon the course of history. One such figure, obviously, is Martin Luther King. How would you like to begin, Manya, by listening to Martin Luther King?
Sounds good to me.
That would set the
tone.
Sure,
absolutely.
You will recognize this instantly. It is, of course, his single best-known speech, the one delivered in Washington on the Mall on that great day. Here it is.
I have a dream that one day, this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. Yeah. I have a dream that one day sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream. My four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream. We will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last, thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
Was there ever such a moment?
It was really extraordinary. And the backstory for that speech, I think, is fascinating because as the preparations for the March on Washington came to a conclusion, there was King was exhausted, as I understand the story. He was tired. He got up to do the speech. His heart really wasn't in it because he was so spent. And he started speaking. And you can hear this in the first part of that speech. And he just didn't have his rhythm. And then somebody behind him, and according to one of the stories I've heard, it was Aretha Franklin, had heard him do a riff on the dream speech. This was not a new rhetorical device.
He had done those lines earlier in the speech,
right,
in Detroit.
In Detroit, that's right. And she said, "Tell him about the dream, Martin." And then he got going. It just, you know, it clicked, and he went off. And it was, you know, as you said, one of the great speeches of all American history. Or
and he would certainly history. He would certainly count as well as one of the great religious leaders who altered history itself.
Most definitely. And, you know, it's so funny. I've been hearing a lot about Martin Luther King lately because I've been talking to a lot of clergy and folks who are getting involved in the Occupy movement across the country, whether it be in New York or Boston, D.C. or here in Chicago. And they reference Martin Luther King every other sentence, because I think they're craving that moment again in America. And they're really, you know, looking to him for inspiration to really fuel this movement and the role of the movement. So, yeah, I think that they're hoping to make such an impact on history as he did.
Well, I hope not. I take that Occupy movement to be irresponsible and ill-conceived and ill-directed.
A lot of people said that about Martin Luther King.
I didn't. matter of fact, I had some contact with Martin Luther King,
being
the older person at this table. That will be for another time. The general focus then that kind of comes to mind is, if I can sort of do this in a rather pretentious way, it's a Carlylean focus. Thomas Carlyle did the great book back in the first half of the 19th century on heroes and the hero in history. And by hero, he doesn't mean somebody that we would all universally and eternally admire, but he means somebody who had a large presence and made a difference and in some ways altered the course of history. I don't know that all the people I've got in mind and for whom we've got sound clips altered the course of history, but some of them surely represent strong and important historical themes. And I'm going to play a clip of one of those right after we pause for these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
My guests tonight are two religionists, two students of religion, I should say, though clearly Randall Balmer is as well a religionist, a leading historian of American religion, and you've just disclosed to me something I truly did not know, that we've met a number of times before. For the last 5 years, you've been an Episcopal priest.
That's right.
As well as a professor at Columbia.
That's right.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And Manya Brashear, of course, is the religion reporter, though she does other things as well, at the Chicago Tribune. Just this morning, you were editing the paper, is that right?
I was sending reporters out on various assignments
You're the Sunday morning.
Provide the daily coverage in Monday's paper, yeah.
The Sunday morning managing editor?
Assignment editor, yeah.
Assignment editor,
yeah.
That looks towards Monday's paper.
Exactly.
I get
exactly.
it.
Exactly. So you can almost always find a religion story in Monday's paper when I'm in charge.
Now, here's a man who made a lot of interesting news and was a very significant figure. Indeed, he was a television star, one of the first television stars, I would suppose the first religious television star, namely Bishop Fulton Sheen. He became bishop only later in his life.
Right.
At that time, he was Monsignor Fulton Sheen.
That's right.
What fill us in on him. A good deal about him.
Fulton Sheen was an enormously important figure, in part because he came to public notice and public prominence at a time when Catholics were trying to become a part of the fabric of American life, and particularly in the post-war period, Catholics had sons of immigrants had fought in World War II and kind of thereby proved their Americanness, and Fulton Sheen provides a public face for the church and for Catholicism, and he helps to integrate Catholics into the mainstream and middle class of American life.
And also he picks up on one of the main concerns and one of the main purposes of the Catholic Church in the world in those days, namely its anti-Soviet position.
That's right. That's right. I reviewed a book that's just out about religion in the Cold War, and he was the celebrity converter of people from communism to Catholicism. Right?
Have you ever seen any of those videos?
You know, I've seen a couple of videos. It's interesting. I mean, Fulton Sheen, what he really also got was TV. I mean, he was one of the early televangelists who put on the full Catholic garb. And yeah, as you said,
he even had a cape. He always had a cape
on. Yes, he did, right.
Under
right.
his...
That's right.
I don't know what you call the kind of, costume he wore, but it was high churchy.
High church.
Very high churchy. And the Peoria Diocese, I know for quite a few years, has been pursuing a cause for sainthood.
Of
Fulton Sheen, yeah. I don't know if they've abandoned that effort, but I know that it was going on for quite some time.
He had what the Italians call presenza. He had great presence,
right.
And he was really hypnotically interesting as you watched him on that black and white small screen way back, I guess, in the 1960s and the 1970s.
Well, I think he was on beginning in the 50s.
As early as that.
Yes.
Here he is.
We want predetermination there because there's reality and there's myth. The people are real, they want the truth, but they're submerged by this myth. So we say to them, listen to this statement. I will tell you later who said it, but we address it to the Soviets. If any nation whatsoever is detained by force within the boundaries of a certain state, and if that nation, contrary to its expressed desire, is not given the right to determine the form of its state life by free voting and completely free from the presence of troops of the annexing or stronger state and without any pressure, then the incorporation of that nation by the stronger state is annexation, it is seizure by force, it is violence. Who said this? Nikolai Lenin. Then Soviets, under God, follow it. Free these people. That's the first thing that we have to solve in the world. And then our other problems will be solved. No other problem will be solved until we liberate them. They're strong. They're very strong. Why? Because they believe in an absolute. They believe in a truth. The truth of the party line, and they believe in it with such fervor and faith that they are. Is that 2640? Is that time for me to quit? Is that 2640? 1 minute yet? See, I get so rattled. But they have a faith in an absolute. And that gives them great strength and great zeal. Our weakness, really, is the fact that we are not sure in America that there is any truth. We are something like Pontius Pilate. When our blessed Lord appeared before him, our Lord said, I am come to give testimony of the truth, and all who are of the truth hear my voice. And Pilate turned his back on truth and sneered, what is truth? They have thrown down the gauntlet. And they have reminded us that the choice before the world is not some humanitarian society and communism. It is either brotherhood in Christ or comradeship in Antichrist. They have chosen that particular comradeship. It is for us as a free nation to choose the truth, to choose the good, to choose and affirm God and the freedom of the peoples of the world.
How about that?
Wow. That was... It was quite political, wouldn't you say?
It was, and what's striking to me is the reference to the Antichrist, because that's generally a Protestant trope, is to invoke the Book of Revelation, and for Fulton Sheen to use that language, I have to say that surprised me a bit.
What was his status within the church? They were very slow in making him a bishop. He was a Monsignor for most of his life.
That's right. I suspect
at the very end, I think he was became the Bishop of Rochester. Was it?
Either
Rochester or Buffalo. One of those.
You're putting me on the spot. I don't remember. My guess is that there was probably some suspicion. I mean, the Roman Catholic Church, let's face it, is not a church that embraces modernity and the fact that which I mean is no criticism, just a description. But I think the fact that he was a media presence, and there was probably some suspicion about that. And I think actually for all religions, there is, I think, a proper suspicion about the role of media in propagating the faith, because it is not, to put it in theological terms, it is not incarnational. It is distant. It is mediated. And the idea that somebody could pick up religious views or ideas through that media is in some ways inimical to the faith.
He may very well have set a model for something quite different that began to appear on the American video screen. The televangelists, mostly of evangelical Protestant orientation.
That's right.
And, well, certainly Oral Roberts was one. Certainly Pat Robertson is a major figure along those lines. And then there were some who disgraced themselves having built empires. We'll talk about – I have at least one of them represented on the playlist as we go further tonight, namely Jimmy Swaggart, who sinned –
That's right. I've sinned against God. Yes.
By the way, I better hold this question off. I'll ask you later. Whatever happened to Jimmy Swaggart? Is he still there? Don't answer.
Okay.
We'll keep people in suspense on that until we listen to Jimmy Swaggart confessing his sins. And we'll proceed with all of that as we go tonight with our two very special guests of the evening, Randall Balmer and Manya Brashear. But now it is time to go to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Randall Balmer and to Manya Brashear and a special playlist that we've worked up tonight. Once the televangelism thing really got going, we had a lot of preaching, to be sure.
Yes.
I guess Catholic preaching, mainline Protestant preaching, and surely evangelical.
Well, the evangelicals really were late in the game because effectively the FCC had kind of crowded them out with the complicity of mainline Protestant denominations for the most part.
I don't know about that caper. How'd they do that?
I probably can't do it justice, but the FCC regulations were that local stations could not charge for religious programming.
Uh-huh.
And which meant that effectively the local stations went to the local National Council of Churches or the Protestant Ministerial Association and the Catholic Church and Jewish religious folks, and then they decided who would get the airtime among themselves. And the FCC in the early 1960s in effect opened up that whole process and allowed stations to sell the airtime to people like Pat Robertson. Pat Robertson saw an opening. He bought this defunct station in Portsmouth, Virginia, and this kind of dubbed it grandly the Christian Broadcasting Network, and everything just took off from there.
That's where it took off, from that point.
Mm-hmm.
Something else comes along. Robertson indeed indulged in this, and others sort of did it full-time, namely faith healing over television,
right,
on a religious
right,
basis.
Right.
And here is one of the fathers of all of that, Oral Roberts.
Yep. All right, now you've got polio from your waist down, and the right side is affected the most. Now, Jesus, we ask that his little limbs be healed and that they shall be restored. Restore them tonight in the name of Christ the Lord. Oh God, loosen that little foot up and take the stiffness. Oh, it's coming now, son. Praise God, praise God, praise God. Thank you, God. Now then, Billy Ray, I want you to raise that leg up like that. Oh, you can do it! Raise this one up, son. Now raise this little leg up, son. Oh, that's wonderful tonight.
It is straightening. How can you tell it's straightening?
Because I couldn't lift my leg up like that.
You couldn't lift it up. Oh, that's wonderful. Brother Deweese, we're going to put him down now. Honey. Oh, he wants down. Honey, walk on off, son. Walk on.
Well, Manja, does that persuade you that miracle healing can, in fact, occur?
I don't dare say that I... who knows? You just never know. It's very possible that that was happening, or maybe it was just a trick on television. I don't know.
Well, I don't know whether Oral Roberts engaged in tricks. There were a number of other people who were investigated by, among others, my old friend James Randy, the amazing Randy.
Oh, yes.
Who worked within the broad context of the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, on whose board I sat, at least in those days. There were two particular people that they followed rather closely. The Reverend Peter Popoff, you know that name?
It sounds vaguely familiar.
And there was another guy, I forget his name now. Peter Popoff was very big on this thing, and he was carried on he bought time on stations all over the country and our what was then the Christian Broadcasting Television Station here in Chicago.
Right.
And he was discovered on the investigation that they ran on him to quite – he had the gift of knowledge.
Yes.
He could find somebody and know the person's name, know his address, and that his doctor was Dr. Goldberg, and who told him so-and-so about his arthritis, about his arthritis. but we're going to heal all of that this very night. But he knew all of this about it because they required everybody for the 2 or 3 hours before they started doing the video and filming anything. They required everybody to fill out so-called prayer cards or request cards telling what their affliction was and so on.
Wow.
Some local preachers, it turns out, gave those cards in their own congregations in advance of the meeting. They were working with Popoff in all naivete, I'm sure, and then supplied those cards because that was to help Popoff and his staff kind of focus the healing power of Jesus on these particular people whom they would concentrate on even before the great revival occasion.
Yeah.
Everything was – all the information was available to him, and it was discovered that his wife, who was one of his major colleagues in all of this, was talking to him on a little radio transmission, and he, though he could do miracle healing of all sorts, had a little thing stuck in his ear indicating that maybe it was a hearing aid. And she was telling him, on the third row, that lady, the gray-haired lady sitting three persons in, that's Mrs. Jenkins, and she has heart trouble.
Wow.
And he would do the whole routine that way.
Well, there have been a lot of
with regard to people who were lame and would jump out of their wheelchairs and walk and run, very often the wheelchairs were supplied by the miracle healer in advance of going on air.
There have been a lot of charlatans through the years.
Terrible,
no question
terrible.
About that. But I have to say, I haven't done these investigations, but I'm with Manya. I'm not prepared entirely to dismiss the possibility that there's something happened. And there have been rather persuasive accounts of people who have at least claimed healing from
well, not as a religionist, but as a psychologist, I would have to, of course, also grant that a great deal can be done by alteration of attitude and alteration of expectation.
Sure. The power of positive thinking.
The power of positive thinking. And the power of being pushed on the head, heal, and let Jesus enter you and heal. Mm-hmm. And they knock you over and you fall on the floor. They catch you.
That's right.
The whole panorama of that particular kind of stagey ritual must have been very persuasive to some naive people who came in there thinking that they had something wrong with them.
I think that's right. And I think part of the problem with television and with these productions is that this becomes routinized. So you have, as you say, people pushing on the head. You have some the catchers behind the individual who catch them. And if it's a woman wearing a skirt, then someone comes along and lays something over her legs to maintain modesty and so forth. But even the speaking in tongues, which is a spiritual gift. It's talked about in the New Testament, and I've heard it many times, and it's very persuasive. Other contexts, I've heard it as well, and it seems contrived. It seems to be mimicry of some sort, and that's a shame.
Well, there have been studies on echolalia, which is speaking in tongues, and it has a certain – it tends to be very heavy on simple syllabic consonant-vowel, alabadabadaba, algararalanum, things of that sort flow very easily. And in other words, it has its own linguistic structure.
Yes, exactly. Right.
And never do we get speaking in tongues as the Bible tells you, namely that people start talking known other languages which they don't know. You get claims that somebody in the middle of a service is talking in Chinese, but there's no Chinese person there to verify it.
Yes.
I was going to ask, Mel, what's the difference between echolalia and glossolalia?
I think it's glossolalia I meant to say.
Okay.
Echolalia
right.
is something else.
Yes.
Okay.
And xenolalia is the ability to speak a known foreign language without having studied it. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, we're told that we are the most religious of all Western nations, and by the measure of church attendance, synagogue attendance, mosque attendance these days in this country, I suppose that is true. Mm. But you remember in a line in Bellow's The Adventures of Augie March, he says of somebody, way down deep, he's shallow. And is it possible that American religiosity way down deep is rather shallow?
Oh, I mean, I think it depends on who you ask. There's certainly segments of the population that it's all for appearance, right? And it's not deeply felt. But I think there's also a significant segment of American society that it drives and motivates everything they do. What they read in the scriptures, what they hear from the pulpit, that's what fuels their lives and informs them. And
when you do opinion surveys on this, as the Pew Bunch and others have done, you find that 70 or 80% of Americans say yes, they believe in an afterlife, et cetera, et cetera. They believe right. You can be redeemed through the blood of Jesus and so on and so on. What's so curious about this, and you must have thought about this a great deal, Randall, you and your colleagues looking at American religious history, is that all of this has faded in Europe, in Western Europe.
It has.
Why the difference between England, France, Germany, the Low Countries, and the United States with regard to religious faith?
I think I won't speak for my colleagues. My personal conviction on this is it's the First Amendment. The First Amendment set up a free marketplace for religion in America. And that explains a lot of what we're talking about today, because it means that you have, to extend the economic metaphor, you have religious entrepreneurs who are always out there competing for audiences. And that lends an unmistakably populist cast to religion in America. And it also lends vitality to religion.
You're endorsing the free market.
Absolutely. It does. And what's significant, too, is that Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, published in 1776, arguably the most important thing that happened in 1776, the example he cites, or one of the examples he cites, is religion. If you allow religion to be unregulated, you will have a flourishing, thriving religious market. And I think American history is the perfect example of that. Mm. It vindicated Adam Smith's theories, in my judgment.
In other words, you don't make it part of the government institution.
Absolutely.
You don't make that part of the governmental institution, and you let people reform and recreate take control of their own religious institutions and faith systems.
I think religion has thrived in this country precisely because the government has stayed out of the religion business.
At least it's some wonderful verbal ticks and tricks. Disestablishmentarianism was a movement which favors undoing of established churches.
That's right.
They should be disestablished.
That's right.
And anti-disestablishmentarianism is the opposition to attempting to disestablish established churches.
I guess that's right. Yeah. But in America, you have the First Amendment. In fact, I was just lecturing about this in my class the other day. You have the First Amendment, which Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And it wasn't until 1818 in Connecticut and 1833 in Massachusetts that the states finally did away with establishment. And in Connecticut, which is where I live, Lyman Beecher was adamantly opposed to this. He thought this would be the end of faith in Connecticut. And he had these heartrending jeremiads about how we can't disestablish the church, the Congregational Church in Connecticut. 2 years after disestablishment, he writes, "It's the best thing that ever happened to religion in Connecticut," to get rid of state support, because religion was finally unfettered and was allowed to flourish.
I wonder if religion flourishes here much more than it does in the West European countries, obviously. Does atheism and strong denunciations of religion also flourish here more than it does, say, in our cousin countries in Western Europe? We've had this spate of new atheists. Christopher Hitchens is perhaps one of the best known. Richard Dawkins, a very considerable figure in scientific teaching, if not in doing original research, but the great advocate of evolutionary theory in the latter day. These are authors of strong atheistic screeds done as books. I don't know that the same thing is happening in Europe, but I'm not sure.
I'm probably going to rile up all the atheists who are listening to the show, but I actually happen to believe that atheism has become its own religious institution, its own kind of organized movement. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's certainly true in America. Whether that's happened in Europe, I'm not really sure. You hear the voices from Europe that are, you know, strong atheist voices, but I'm not sure if it's as much of an organized movement.
I don't think it is, because religion, I mean, what are they pushing against here in the United States?
Right.
They're pushing against religion. And if you don't have a strong religious life, what are they pushing against? No, I agree with Manya I sometimes call these folks the secular fundamentalists. And it's been flourishing lately. And I think, frankly, it is in many ways a reaction to the politicization of religion in America. That's what's kind of got them riled up. And I understand those impulses.
Should religion have a role in our political life? This is a question worth raising. Well, it's a question worth raising in a more particular context. I raise it even as we're about to pause for some commercials. But maybe we could talk about this a little bit afterwards. Should it have a particular role in our political choices at a time when a great election is coming? Religion is part of the argument, it seems to me, particularly as regards evangelicalism on the one hand, Mormonism on the other hand. Within the Republican Party, you can launch attacks on that basis. Outside of the Republican Party, from the Democratic Party looking on, once the Republicans have selected a candidate, the attack may, though it will be done sub rosa, never acknowledged as part of the official line, but sub rosa, they can really also attack the candidate for either being an evangelical or for being a Mormon. As the two leading candidates, if you don't count Herman Cain, who may or may not be a flash in the pan, one doesn't know. But it's going to be in the air, but sub rosa, not coming from acknowledged sources from the Democratic National Committee. Let's talk about this. I think I've opened a realm, even though I'm sort of blundering about it. But I'm very worried about the misuse of religion, of defamation of religion as a mode and method of political argument. We return directly to our two very special guests of the evening, namely Randall Balmer and Manya Brashear, after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
As we return to conversation with Randall Balmer and Manya Brashear, of course, what we all have in mind, thinking about American presidential political history in more or less the modern era, is the way in which the candidacy of John Fitzgerald Kennedy was attacked by essentially Southern Baptist types. Isn't that right?
That's right. Yeah, there was a lot of criticism, a lot of rhetoric of fear that Roman Catholic would be taking his orders
from some of the ministers actually spoke up publicly along those lines.
That's right. Yeah, and Kennedy had to address the issue at the Rice Hotel in Houston on September 12th, 1960, made his famous speech, which I think is really quite a remarkable speech, in which he said, in effect, that voters should bracket out a candidate's faith when they went into the voting booth. And my argument, I wrote a book on this called God in the White House, How Faith Shaped the Presidency from John F. Kennedy to George W. Bush. And what I argue there is that Kennedy's made the case so persuasively that religion was not a factor in presidential politics from 1960 until the mid-1970s with the rise of Jimmy Carter.
Will it come back again as a strong undercurrent in presidential politics if either Perry or Romney get the nomination?
I think it's already come back. I think it came back during the 2008 campaign when folks took the opportunity to pick on, you know, Barack Obama's church and the African American church tradition. Will it be back? And Mitt Romney's Mormon faith. Remember, he had that big speech where he tried to explain the role that his faith played. And yes, I think that he's going to have to make more of those speeches if he continues to be a front runner in the campaign. And I think that you know, Rick Perry, before he announced, he held a big prayer rally in Houston in the sports stadium. And so certainly religion plays a huge role in his life and the decisions that he makes. And yeah, it could certainly become a discussion.
I think so. I think Romney, frankly, has not handled the issue very well to this point. I think, you know, if I were advising him, which I certainly am not, but he, especially in the 2008 campaign, he was always dodging the issue. He was saying, I'm not a theologian. I don't speak for my church. And unfortunately, that for him politically, that reinforced the impression that many people have of him as being kind of all over the place in terms of issues. But I think if he had said, yes, I'm a Mormon. This is part of who I am. This is part of my my family. This is helps me understand my place in the world, my responsibility to others. And I recognize that not all Americans will understand my faith commitments, but I don't apologize for them. I don't back down from them. I think if he had done that, he might have had a bit less trouble with the issue 4 years ago. What, again, is striking to me is that 40 years earlier, I was living in Michigan at the time, in Bay City, Michigan, and George Romney, Mitt's father, was, of course, running for the Republican presidential nomination.
Former governor of Michigan.
Governor of Michigan, and really quite a remarkable man in many ways. And as I was doing research on the book, I found absolutely nothing about George Romney's Mormonism being a factor, as I'm sure that you remember that what did in his candidacy was his remark that he'd been brainwashed about Vietnam. Nothing about his Mormonism. But now religion is so much part of American presidential politics. And I think the reason for that is that in America, religion serves as a proxy for morality. And what I mean by that is that we want to know about our politicians, particularly our presidential candidates, are they good, decent, honorable people? And the only way we know how to ask that question is to ask, are you religious? And that's a very poor question because the underlying flawed assumption behind that question is that someone who is not religious cannot be a moral person. Well, that's just demonstrably false. That's not the case. But we ask the question anyway. And the real problem is that we as the voters settle for the answers. We don't interrogate the claims. The classic example to me is George W. Bush in the Des Moines Register debate before the Iowa precinct caucuses in 2000 when he declared that Jesus was his favorite political philosopher. Well, I'm not criticizing that statement, even though a lot of people did, but the real tragedy of that exchange is that nobody followed up. Governor Bush, your favorite philosopher, called on his followers to be peacemakers, to turn the other cheek, to love their enemies. He also expressed concern for the tiniest sparrow. Will those sentiments find any resonance in your policies as president? And the point is not to play a game of theological gotcha. That's not the point. The point is that when candidates raise the issue of faith and religion, I think we as the voters have an obligation to interrogate those claims to find out how deep they are.
There's also the question of whether some of our very active, visible, audible political figures are as religious as they represent themselves to be. A basic part of having a public political career is to lay on the religiosity.
Sure, it's and again, I think it's because that in America, religion is a proxy for morality, and that's how we it's a very flawed way of getting at the question of integrity in my judgment.
Can you imagine any political candidate when asked about this or in earlier in his political career when he has to define himself in those terms, says, "Well, no, I'm not Jewish, I'm not Christian, I'm not Muslim, I am a humanist."
Yeah.
Could any you might be able to say that in Boston and get away with it, but you couldn't do it running for a Senate in any state and certainly not running for the presidency.
No, at this point, no. I think it'll come. I think it'll come. But, you know, as we were talking before, you know, neither of us ever thought that an African American would be elected president. In the 50s, it was unthinkable that a Roman Catholic would be elected president. And I think that one of the great things about this country, one of the things that makes me patriotic, is that we Americans eventually come around to our better selves and recognize the merits of others and the rights of minorities.
At the moment, I don't think that a Muslim can become president, but who knows?
It'll be a while.
Who knows? We are about to pause for a full update on the evening's news, and then directly back. So in about 15 minutes, we're going to go to the phones for any questions that this conversation has stirred in your mind or in your heart. 312-591-7200 is where you reach us, 312-591-7200. You can get in there early if you don't mind waiting in line a bit, and we'll be on to the phones, as I say, in about 15 minutes. Also, of course, another way to reach us is email. The email address, as ever, is extension 720 at wgnradio.com. Extension 720, as one word, at wgnradio.com, or for phones, 312-591-7200, and with that, to the WGN newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
How would you like another sound clip or two?
Let's
do it. Before we go to the phones, which we'll do in about 15 minutes. Again, I invite all listeners who've got anything. If you've got other important religious leaders to mention and to talk about, ones that we have not got around to, by all means, feel free to give us a call. If, for that matter, you've got reflections on the careers of such people as we have discussed, give us a call. And you may very well have reflections on the matter I'm about to broach right now, namely the sexual scandals in TV evangelicalism. For any or all such topics, the phone number 312-591-7200, 312-591-7200. Let us come to a quick review of that interesting phase. I thought at the time it might kill televangelism. It hasn't really done so. But the affairs of involving Swaggart and Jim Baker and Tammy Faye Baker, who else was caught?
A little less spectacularly, Oral Roberts declared that God would call him home unless God's people ponied up something like $4.5 million. First time that I'm aware of that God had taken anybody hostage.
But it wasn't a sexual scandal.
No, it was not.
An outrageous story. As a matter of fact, God had called him home through in the person of Jesus, who appeared before him standing a mile high.
Or 700 feet or something
or
like that.
Feet.
I think there were two different instances
two
there.
Two different visions.
Right?
Yeah.
Yes.
But did Jim Baker fall before Jimmy Swaggart or vice versa?
Yes. Actually, what part of the thing that made the Swaggart fall so hard was that Swaggart had criticized Jim Baker as one of these pretty boy preachers, and then the whole Jim and Tammy Faye thing began to unravel.
And Jim and Tammy were a breakoff from the Robertson shop.
That's right.
The Robertson program.
That's right. Jim and Tammy Faye Baker really made Pat Robertson's Christian Broadcasting Network in the early days. And then Robertson, in effect, trucked it over, which he had the right to do, and the Bakers acknowledged that. They went out to California and helped to found Trinity Broadcasting Network, and then they were eliminated from that, then went to North Carolina and Fort Mill, South Carolina, and formed the PTL Network and Heritage USA, which at the time was, in the 1980s, was the third most popular tourist destination
It was an amusement park.
It was a music park, right.
But a Christian amusement park.
Yes, right. Heritage USA.
Great big water slides.
Slides and Billy Graham's home and all sorts of stuff.
Billy Graham's home?
Yes, they took Billy Graham's childhood home and put it in the park. Yeah.
But what a falling off was there. What happened?
Well, what happened was that Jim Baker had a tryst with a church secretary from Long Island and then paid her hush
money.
Jessica Hahn, that's right.
I don't know why I remember
that's
that
right.
Name,
well, it was. I mean, as you remember, in the 80s, this was big news. The highest rated program for Nightline.
I must confess we had some real fun with it
on
this program.
Did. Everybody
when
did.
One of Manya's predecessors as religion reporter for the Tribune and Jim Wall of the Christian Century and Martin Marty perhaps and other such people, we would do a religion news review. And for two or three of those in a row, and they occurred once or twice a year, those religion news review programs, we could not but go on talking about the scandals within televangelism.
It was extraordinary. It was great television for a lot of folks, but sad as well. And actually, that's what prompted me to write Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory. Is that I was at that time a new professor at Columbia, and I'm really trained as a colonial historian. But what I wanted to do was to show that not all evangelicals in America were the moral equivalent of Jim Baker and Jimmy Swaggart. And so I set out to travel around the country and write about evangelicalism at the grassroots, where I think the real integrity of the movement is, and not with the televangelists.
Of course, it was another aspect of the falling off. There wasn't only the sexual scandal, which these days is utterly routine. All you have to do is say, I'm sorry if I've offended anybody, and you go right back to whatever privileged position you've got. But there was financial finagling of a very significant sort. He wound up in federal prison.
He did, yeah, with an exorbitant sentence that was far too excessive for the crime. And he did his time, and now he's last I heard he was in East Los Angeles doing God's work.
Then Jimmy Swaggart, who condemned him originally,
that's right,
winds up in the very same situation.
Well, it's an odd situation. He was discovered checking into Louisiana motel rooms with prostitutes for what he claimed were voyeuristic sorts of activities. He claimed there was no real sexual encounter, but still, of course, that was enough to expose him to ridicule, but also to censure from the Assemblies of God. He was off the air for a while, and then he simply couldn't keep his empire afloat without being on television, so he went back to television.
And here he is making amends and confessing to his very, very large congregation that he had sinned.
It may be dark days for the Swaggart Church, but as the sky cleared, his congregation in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, were to turn out in force. Families anxious to show that their leader could come back with a clear conscience. It was only 3 months ago that they'd heard this.
I have sinned against you, my Lord. And I would ask that your precious blood...
Today they knew all the details. Swaggart had been with a New Orleans prostitute. And to a packed house of 5,000 people who listened with heads bowed, Swaggart prayed for forgiveness again.
If he sees fit for me to sweep floors in a mission, and I mean this, I'm not being self-serving, I mean it from my heart. In a little mission across the track, I would be honored to do anything for him and do it the rest of my life.
The Swaggart ministry chose not to release pictures of the Reverend at his most vociferous, but this sound tape gives some idea of the frenzy which followed.
Don't look at the guilt! Look at the blood! Look God right in the eye! Because Jesus has washed you and cleansed you! That's justification!
Television evangelism in America is a huge money spinner and makes billions of dollars. But Swaggart's sermons will no longer be seen live outside the United States because his expulsion from his mother church, the Assemblies of God, means he does not have access to international satellites. Swaggart himself is predicting a tough time and he is pleading for cash. He used to receive donations of around $500,000 a day. Since the scandal, that has been halved. Now revenue commissioners are looking at the huge ministry, which is one of Baton Rouge's biggest employers, and they're investigating the Swaggart lifestyle. His home and plush furnishings inside cost millions. But Jimmy Swaggart is a survivor. His war cry now that God loves a sinner. And in his own state, at least, he could emerge even stronger than before. This is Michael McMillan for the 1 o'clock news in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
The 1 o'clock news that is on BBC. This is
it
this
like
English guy is having great fun reporting.
he is. Yeah, I went back to visit Jimmy Swaggart 10 years after his...
He is still in...
He's still, yeah.
...in ministry?
He is, but it's really kind of a sad state of affairs. It's a skeleton of what it once was. It's very clear, and Swaggart is still trying to hold forth and hold on. I think he'd love nothing more than to pass on the ministry to his son Donnie Swaggart, but that's always very difficult. The generational thing in religion, in any religion, is a fraught issue. I always cite Chaim Potok's novel The Chosen as an example of that difficulty, but especially when you have the issue of charismatic authority, as you did, and there's few people in this world more charismatic than Jimmy Swaggart, it's very difficult to pass that along. So it was quite sad, actually, to see it.
Do we have any? Have we had in Chicago religious life anything equivalent in terms of the style of preaching?
In terms of the style of preaching, Chicago has its own cast of characters and its own styles. I would
say... Let us now praise famous preachers. Chicago preachers.
Speaking of presidential politics and religion and what I mentioned earlier, I mean, Reverend Jeremiah Wright was a very well-known, well-renowned, still is a well-renowned preacher. His successor at Trinity, Reverend Otis Moss III, an amazing preacher with a completely different style, but just as appealing
the,
and
the same
charismatic
theological
in the pulpit.
Line?
Pretty much the same theological line, yeah. I mean, African-American Protestant church.
The same contempt for mainline America?
I don't know that he shares any kind of contempt with for mainline America.
Surely Jeremiah Wright conveyed some of that.
And we aren't going to debate that right now. But but in terms of style and just appealing to the crowds and you know, and spreading the gospel, I think mm-hmm. Otis Moss is definitely and Jeremiah Wright both would be good Chicago characters
and
for that.
Big. A church out in the suburbs. What is it?
So Willow Creek Community Church in Barrington, Illinois. Bill Hybels is their senior pastor, and he has a very different preaching style. He certainly is very kind of calm, laid back, rational, reasonable. You know, just very not Jimmy Swaggart, but appealing nonetheless. I mean, people flock to that church, thousands of them, to hear his very, very appealing
message.
Another
church that people flock to is just around the corner, so to speak, from where we are at the moment. Is it the Third or the Fourth Presbyterian Church?
Ah, Fourth Presbyterian Church.
Right on Michigan Avenue,
right on the Mag Mile.
What's the name of the preacher there?
John Buchanan is the longtime pastor there, and he's retiring. Within months, I may have my dates wrong, but
he's famous for great sermons.
He's on the road to retirement. He is. But again, I would call his style almost austere, kind of dignified and...
The Scottish tradition of preaching. Scots are great preachers.
But also wonderful to listen to.
We're late for a batch of commercials. We'll take care of that. And then we want to get directly onto the phone. So I've got one or two other recorded bits that I hope to play before we finish tonight. But right now, if you want to pose a question, offer a thought, talk about some major figure in American religious history, whether past or presently functioning and inspiring some people, possibly you, or antagonizing some people, possibly you, 312-591-7200. The lines are open. If you want to get in there, do it quickly, please. 312-591-7200. And the email address is particularly valuable for our internet listeners someplace far away in this country or overseas. And that email address is extension720@wgnradio.com. We'll be directly onto your contributions after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
My guest tonight, as we're talking, and I'm afraid I'm talking too much and having some fun just remembering some of these people. It was the gathering together of some of these sound clips that sort of got me off on this tack. But our guests tonight are Randall Balmer and Manya Brashear. Randall Balmer is professor of the history of religion at Columbia University, and he is the co-author of a book published a few years ago and just now republished in a second edition. Is that right?
That's right, yes.
Titled Religion in American Life by John Butler, Grant Wacker, and Randall Balmer, published by Oxford University Press. And Manya Brashear is, of course, as most listeners already know, the Religion Beat reporter here for the Chicago Tribune, though she's got other duties at the paper. 312-591-7200 is the number, and we'll go first. And there's room available on the board. Any question you've got about American religious life, its history, or its present status, do get in there quickly. 312-591-7200. And first up is John. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Good evening, Doctor, and your distinguished guests. I wonder if they would talk about Rabbi Schneerson. Certainly in the Jewish community, Rabbi Schneerson was the fabled head of the Lubavitcher movement. There's even a offshoot of that movement that actually believes he may rise up again.
Yes, he was considered by many to be the long-promised Messiah. Manya, you were on that beat. There's a large Lubavitcher Chabad group here in Chicago, and you've surely dealt with them, haven't you?
There is. There is a sizable Lubavitch population. And
maybe we should first define for all of our listeners what Lubavitch means.
And you might have to help me, Milt. It's a very ultra-conservative, Orthodox Jewish movement, messianic movement that believes Rabbi Schneerson is the Messiah, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
More broadly, the Lubavitch are just one of a number of so-called Hasidic groups. Mm-hmm. The tradition is Hasidism, mm-hmm. which is a kind of revivalist orthodoxy with joy.
A lot of enthusiasm.
Yeah. And very evangelical, since we're talking about evangelicals tonight a lot, I would say that the Lubavitch movement, have a very evangelical, missional...
But only to Jews.
Only to Jews or people who have a history of Judaism in their families, right? To bring them back into the fold.
Exactly.
So that's I hope that's an adequate summary of the Lubavitch movement. There is a sizable population here in Chicago. I've had some wonderful encounters at synagogues in West Rogers Park. But the Chabad are at most college campuses. Question. What was the question? Where he kind of fits into the whole constellation of...
As Messiah. I think...
But also a charismatic figure, too. Absolutely.
Very much so. Yeah.
You know, one thing about Schneerson actually is I did a profile of a rabbi here, Herman Shalman.
I read that piece of yours. It was excellently done.
So several months ago, earlier this year, when he was celebrating an important birthday, 96.
Thereabouts.
And a very important wedding anniversary, 60 years with his wife. And we had a series of conversations because one interview was just not enough, nor was two, and nor were three interviews. But I finally had to cut it off and write the darn thing. He had read this book about Schneerson. It was a biography of him, and it had completely changed his approach to Judaism. This was a man who left Germany, whose parents had been in concentration camps during the Holocaust. He had a very his approach to Judaism was, to make the world a better place. But he just had a completely different approach to God after reading that biography of Schneerson, just a simple biography. And so that to me spoke to Schneerson's impact and power in Judaism.
You can find a good, I was looking for some Schneerson as a possible extra clip to play tonight, but all of it is in Yiddish. You find it on YouTube. And though I can more or less understand it, it wouldn't really work as extended.
Listeners wouldn't be moved as you would.
but he's a fascinating figure. And if you want to see him and see the tremendous devotion that was felt towards him, he really conducted what is called, what used to be represented as the court of the Rebbe. It was dynastic. And indeed, there was an earlier Rabbi Schneerson who was not his father, but rather his father-in-law. Mm. And the authority was handed down along dynastic lines. I guess that's about all we can say about that. And our thanks to the caller. And let's go quickly to another, 312-591-7200, as we go to Roger. Good evening, sir.
Good evening. I would hold up for ridicule Harold Camping, who is in charge of quite a few radio stations across America, who has predicted the end of the world several times, and we're still here. And for admiration, I would hold up Barbara Brown Taylor one of the most person that has the best sermons you can imagine as a pastor. I certainly admire her and her message that she gives to people.
I don't know anything really about either of those. Let's get some further elaboration from Randy.
Harold Camping is a radio personality, as the caller said, as Roger said, from Oakland, California, who predicted the end of the world in May, I think May 21st.
Mm-hmm.
And then just this past Friday. Supposed to be he revised his calculations. But this is part of a long tradition in American history, and one of the things certainly we write about in this little book.
It's a tradition in universal Christian history.
It is, absolutely. And probably the most famous precedent for this was William Miller, who was a farmer and Bible interpreter from Loehampton, New York, who believed that Jesus was going to return on the basis of his calculations sometime between March 21st, 1843 and March 21st, 1844. Jesus didn't show up, and so he curiously enough, put the date at October 22nd, 1844. And then again, Jesus didn't show up. And that is known in Adventist history as the Great Disappointment, capital G, capital D. Out of that movement came the Seventh-day Adventist Church and also the Advent Christian Church. But there have been various people throughout American history who have tried to predict the end of the world. Barbara Brown Taylor is a wonderful preacher. I agree with Roger about that. Very theologically astute. Has taught preaching to various places and has also been an Episcopal priest and minister, and I admire her greatly as well.
You know, the mention of Harold Camping kind of brings me back to the conversations we were having before this about Jimmy Swaggart, about Jim Baker, you know, and their falls from grace, but the followers who gave money to those ministries and how disappointing that must have been for them. That's what makes me so sad about those stories.
Exactly.
And I think that Harold Camping, the mention of him reminded me that there were a lot of people who pinned a lot of hopes on his predictions in May. To be honest, I don't know. I think they lost faith by October, but this past week. But in May, people were giving up, I mean, sending life savings and really changing their lives, preparing for this prediction to come true. And then it didn't. And where does that leave them? You know what? It just kind of reminded me of collateral damage.
This is the danger of charismatic authority. I mean, it's very attractive. It's like, and people respond to it like a moth to a flame, unfortunately, as you say. And it is sad that, mm-hmm. that people get duped.
But it must be noted that charismatic authority is involved in the very foundation of new religions.
Absolutely.
Whether totally new religions, as Christianity was.
Right.
Was Jesus charismatic? And if he wasn't, surely Paul was.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I think Jesus was very charismatic.
And Martin Luther would surely count as.
Sure.
And Muhammad would count as charismatic.
That's right. And I mean, more recently, Malcolm X, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I've got a clip of Louis Farrakhan, which we haven't yet played. We really ought to get into that interesting aspect of American religious history in recent years. Right now, though, we go to the WGN newsroom for a full update from, as ever, Paula Cooper.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
We have talked about Christianity, basically, with one reference to Hasidism recently in response to a phone call. Something we've not talked about at all is Islam in America. That's a vast subject, and I don't mean to get into it in full detail, but rather most interesting and most readily available in terms of dramatic figures in the pulpit, so to speak, is black Islam. It begins with, there must have been forms of it even before Wallace Fard.
Yes.
But the black Muslim movement as we know it began with a man named Wallace Fard, right?
In the ghettos of Detroit, telling African Americans that their real heritage was as Moors or Moorish Americans, which goes back to a previous movement, the Moorish Holy Temple of Science out of Newark, New Jersey, and other northern cities, mm-hmm. drawing on various different traditions, including Garveyism, and it evolves into this fascinating movement in the 20th century.
Was it at the height of Elijah Muhammad's preaching, was it in any serious sense true Islam, or was it something else?
No, it wasn't. And maybe Manya wants to address this. No, and the Moorish Holy Temple of Science was not Islam either. But it was the importance of the movement is that it provided an identity to African Americans who felt marginalized, particularly in northern cities because of economic and social conditions and so forth. And it was only after the death of Elijah Muhammad that the movement under his son Wallace Dean Muhammad moves to Orthodox Islam.
And he ultimately moves away from
Absolutely.
The black Muslim organization.
That's
and
right.
Starts, he becomes a, after making the Hajj to Mecca and after considerable study and so on, and some difficulty in dissociating himself from his father's movement, he finally does and establishes really a whole network of essentially serious Sunni mosques around
That's right.
the country.
That's right.
Basically for blacks, but others can be observed there as well.
That's
there's
right.
a, there's a very great one. I'm sure you've been to it, Manya, on 51st Street,
mm-hmm.
or is it 47th Street?
Ooh, I'm not positive what the address is, but I think that there was a kind of a power play there when Elijah Muhammad mm-hmm. passed, and between Farrakhan and W.D. Muhammad, and W.D. Muhammad did want to take it into a more traditional Muslim direction, and that was where Farrakhan took the Nation of Islam.
Exactly.
You know, there are certainly there are African American Muslims, but then there's the Nation of Islam, which is it's completely separate organization and different theological system.
I am told, I don't know, I have no authority for this, but I'm told by some people who probably do have some such expertise, that the two different movements, the black Muslim, serious Sunni Muslim movement, led by Wallace Dean Muhammad until his death rather recently, numbers about 10 times as much as does in sheer members as does the so-called black Muslim movement led by Farrakhan.
That's right. The Farrakhan movement is really a fraction.
Let us hear him all the same. He's certainly a rather dramatic pulpit figure as well, is he not?
Yeah, absolutely.
Here's some coverage. We hear him in part, and part of it is news coverage.
And I warn my brother, don't you let these wicked demons move you in a direction that will absolutely ruin your future with your people in Africa and throughout the world. They don't like the way you handle Mubarak. They don't like the way you're handling the situation in the Arab world. So I would advise you to be careful and move with wisdom and skill. My advice would be, why don't you organize a group of respected Americans and ask for a meeting with Gaddafi? You can't order him to step down and get out. Who the hell do you think you are? That you can talk to a man that built a country over 42 years and ask him step down and get out? Can anybody ask you? Well, there's a lot now going to ask you to step out of the White House because they don't want no black face in the White House. Be careful, brother.
There you have it. I meant that.
Was that screamier edition at the end?
It's part of what we took off YouTube. I didn't define it in advance. I wanted it to come as perhaps a surprise.
It was a surprise.
Yes, it was.
He's talking to the President of the United States.
Yes, right. Yeah, and you know, here's a...
This is before the assassination of Gaddafi just a day or two
that's
ago.
That's right, yeah. It's a tragic story of unlikely and unfortunate bedfellows, it strikes me.
Yeah, in fact, Minister Farrakhan gave a sermon to his followers earlier this year when we were first going into Libya, and... he was very, very vocal about his disdain for President Obama, who still called Brother Obama, but definitely disagrees with his policies, and his love and loyalty to Gaddafi.
And that should be explained in some parts on the basis of their earlier relationship, which had a strong financial component.
It had a very strong financial component. Mosque Mariam is, as you pointed out earlier, the former Greek Orthodox Church, but it was completely gutted and rehabbed into the
mosque. On Stony Island Avenue.
Exactly. And it was gutted and rehabbed with several million dollars from Gaddafi. He was the one who funded that project. So, yeah, and other various projects that Farrakhan was interested in, Gaddafi provided funding for.
And
so
he had been over to Libya more than once, I think, for special meetings with Gaddafi.
He had. Yeah, he had. But it had been a while since he had spoken to him. In fact, I think that was one of the questions that mm-hmm. reporters asked him that day was, when was the last time you spoke with your good friend? And it had been many years. So,
what does one make of the man and his power? Does he have real power?
Farrakhan, I think he has a very small following, and I think it's important to understand in historical context. We talked about the transition from Elijah Muhammad to W.D. Muhammad, but really that transition away from the Nation of Islam and the militancy of the Nation of Islam as articulated by Elijah Muhammad really began with Malcolm X, who did the Hajj, did the pilgrimage to Mecca, and himself converted to Orthodox or Sunni Islam.
And totally changed his view on everything.
And totally changed everything, and it led to his assassination by the Fruit of Islam, apparently under orders from Elijah Muhammad. And it was, and then when Elijah Muhammad dies, then his son tries to go in the direction of the post-Hajj Malcolm X, and Louis Farrakhan arises in reaction to that and goes to essentially a pre-Hajj Malcolm X.
It's a very dramatic chapter in American religious history.
It is. Another example of, I mean, just to loop back to an earlier conversation in this fascinating couple of hours, an example of a religious entrepreneur coming along, seeing a niche and exploiting it.
We've had a lot of entrepreneurship in American religious history.
Absolutely. That's why I love what I do. And I expect that's why Manya likes what she does, because there are so many fascinating figures from, you know, Bill Hybels to, you know, George Whitefield back in the 18th century and countless others.
Even earlier, Cotton Mather.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
We pause for a last round of commercials, then directly back to the phones. 312-591-7200. I see we've got a number of people waiting. We'll get directly to you. We've also got a few lines available again, so if you want to get into the conversation, move quickly right now to 312-591-7200.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we will go quickly and directly back to the phones on 312-591-7200. Gloria is next. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening, Milt. I originally called and told your producer I wanted to know if your guests had ever heard. When my husband and I were first married in the early 70s, we were hooked on evangelicalism. Jimmy Baker, Swaggart, Pat Robertson, and then one other guy that I don't know if too many people have heard of. He was actually an ordained minister. His name was Reverend Eugene Scott.
Oh, yes.
And he owned a lot of racehorses.
I remember him as a strange presence on television.
Well, what I'm thinking of now, I've gotten a little more philosophical since I've been waiting and listening to you on the phone.
Yeah.
I told your producer, my husband and I used to think of them as street theater. My husband often said Jim Baker went to jail because he overbooked. And Reverend Eugene Scott, we remember we recorded his song, Kill a Pissant for Jesus, and then he would read pledges on the air and throw them on the ground if they weren't big enough. And I contrast that, my life in my 30s, with my life as a kid in a Catholic grade school, and I would watch the Reverend or Bishop Fulton J. Sheen, Life is Worth Living, not only as entertainment, but, I mean, he was a theologian, he was a pastor, he was a minister, and I'm thinking of those two phases in my life. As a 30-year-old, I'm skeptical, I'm sarcastic, I'm perhaps even cruel and blasphemous, but as a 10-year-old kid, Bishop Sheen was just the opposite for me. He was entertaining, but yet, I guess the word is inspiring. I can't think of any other words to use. I'm wondering if either of your guests have heard of any of these people or what their comments would be.
I have. Certainly, Gene Scott was quite a character, as I remember, and he died just, I think, a few years ago, and he was rather irreverent, and he called Jerry Falwell Jerry the Fat, if I remember correctly, but a character, no question about it.
Where did you wind up in terms of your religious identity?
I'm still searching.
But you're not an active Catholic anymore, then?
I like to think I am, but I'm not. I got to be honest. I'm a Latin Mass pre-Vatican II type of person that's simply fallen away.
Well, thank you very much for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Most interesting. There are a few churches in town that do the Latin Mass and are pre-Vatican II in orientation. Isn't that right?
There are. Yeah, there are a couple. And they're packed and have multiple masses. Yeah, that's growing, certainly growing in popularity.
What's one of them? Do you remember?
Oh, I was afraid you might ask. I'm completely... St. John Cantius. Sorry.
That's the one I've heard of
as
well.
Yeah.
Back to the phones. 312-591-7200. And we go to Matthew. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hello, Milt. It's an honor to talk to you. I've been listening to you forever. I remember even as a pre-adolescent, not even understanding anything you said when my dad was listening to you. And now I'm my dad's age and still have the chance. And your voice still sounds the same.
Well, enough of me. Let's talk about you. Which of my programs have you been most interested in?
Oh, you know what?
That's a
All
joke.
Your topics
let's,
and let's, everything.
Let's go
hey,
forward.
Enough about your greatness.
All right.
But
please go ahead.
You know, back with what you guys were saying in the last caller, Gloria. Yeah, the exploitation and then the combination of the television. I guess the fame in that it must just get out of hand, right?
It would be a great temptation. A great lure.
I think it does. And part of the problem with the televangelists is that there's no real institutional apparatus for checking excesses. Now, with Fulton Sheen, I mean that's you have the Catholic hierarchy that effectively functions as a break against any sort of runaway corruption. And when these guys like Swigert and Jim Baker and some of these others were in their heyday, they were their own people, and nobody was telling them what to do, and they were calling the shots. And I think we've seen that again and again, the real dangers of that sort of thing.
And I like how you explained that they were actually like competing machines, weren't they?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And there was a great deal of jealousy, for example, between Jim Baker and Jimmy Swigert.
Now I understand that, because Jim Baker and there were other ones. Oh, and the one you talked about, Milt, that got busted with the hearing thing and the thief-healing, that was Peter Popoff.
Peter Popoff, yeah.
And, you know, those folks just seemed obviously, I didn't understand how people could fall for that. But I remember Jimmy Swigert was pretty straightforward.
Damn.
I mean, he always said, check the scripture. You know, don't believe a man. You know, and it just, wow, the fall of him. I mean, he just wasn't following what he was saying.
That's right. And you know, he's all too human. And that was the impression that I had when I was down and talked with him. And I really came away with great affection for Jimmy Swigert, despite all of his flaws. But let's face it, we're all flawed human beings.
Right.
Thank you, sir, for the call.
Oh, hey, listen, one last thing. Up here in, you know, I live in Kenosha and out of Milwaukee, they're very careful about the people that they put on their Channel 30 up there. They really do checks. And, you know, Charles Stanley and you know, a bunch of different ones. But they're straight ahead. You know, they're not, you know. And I guess I stuck with it, you know, through the years. And I guess my main point is, to be discerning. I wish people could just discern. It's just a shame that people...
Discernment is a great virtue in almost any realm of human interest, including personal relations, including, for that matter, political affiliations. We thank you, sir, for the call. Glad to have heard from you indeed. And I want to read you an email from a rather constant listener in Sydney, Australia. This is my friend Mike in Sydney, who says, Governor Sarah Palin, Pastor John Hagee of Texas, and Glenn Beck have been very vocal in their support of Jews in general and the Jewish state of Israel in particular. Their millions of subscribers and supporters have likewise declared their unyielding allegiance to the Jewish community. Beck even went so far during his recent rally in Israel to address Israel's enemies in an unambiguous way. Quote, if you want to kill the Jew, you'll have to come for me first. He is rather self-dramatizing, this fellow Beck. I've seen him, of course. Mm-hmm. It is quite an interesting and welcome trend, and a far cry from the anti-Semitic brand of historic European Christendom. I'm not sure how welcome a trend it is, frankly, Mike. I appreciate your sentiment, but Beck leaves me a little queasy.
Really? Beck leaves you queasy?
Yeah, I know. You think because I'm a conservative that
I'm really
I would
surprised by that.
It's far too personal. It's far too... elaborated in, I don't know,
but
in personal
is
self-dramatization.
Is he Mormon?
And he is a Mormon.
He's a Mormon,
sure,
and
yeah.
Palin is evangelical, as is Hagee, but two slightly different brands of evangelicalism.
That's right.
So it's interesting that same message would be coming from three different
that's right.
streams.
That's right.
What do you make of Glenn Beck?
I'm probably not the person to ask. I don't watch much television, to be honest. Mm-hmm. But you know, the Mormonism, I think, is interesting. As part of his personal story, as I understand it, it really did change his life, apparently, for to the good. And I'm not the person to discount that in anyone. Just parenthetically, I went out to visit Sarah Palin's church last year, and rooted around a little bit, and it was a fascinating experience, I have to say.
How so?
Well, it's the pastor actually is very nice, and we developed an email correspondence, a kind of email friendship after that visit, and he's a solid kind of down the line evangelical, and so he's very much part of that tradition, and apparently she was shaped by that tradition. Now, apparently she has a couple of churches, and I went to one of them, not the other, but got a sense of I think who she is a little bit from that visit.
What's happening? We only have about 3 or 4 minutes left at most. What's happening in religious life in America right now? What is fermenting? What surprises might we anticipate? Therefore, they won't be totally surprising.
I think that the Occupy movement could take shape, and it could be a stronger clergy presence, quite frankly, that helps it take shape and maybe move into a more productive direction. You had mentioned it being a rather irresponsible movement earlier on. It could remain so, in your opinion, but I think it will start to take shape because of the religious influence and the role of religion. I think that certainly religion is going to play an important role in this upcoming election, as we've talked about.
What I see happening in the 21st century in religion in America is what I call niche religion. That is, you have more and more specialized, targeted appeals to people, even within evangelicalism, which was a huge movement, but it's an internally diverse movement, as I'm sure everybody knows this, certainly around this table. And you don't have the commanding central figure like Billy Graham, who really defined evangelicalism in the 20th century. Instead, you have many, many figures, very exquisitely targeted. I have a student in my class who has spent the last 20 years working for a Christian surfer organization. Now, that's targeted. That's targeted evangelism. The Christian Motorcycle Association and big game hunters and all this stuff. And I think what's happening on the other end in terms of Protestantism, with mainline Protestantism, is that they haven't yet made that transition. They haven't yet figured out how to market themselves. But that comes back to the whole market analogy that we were talking about earlier with a free market. And I think the groups that are growing are learning to target their market, their audience very, very carefully, even exquisitely. Mm-hmm. You even see that out at Willow Creek. You got the big gathering, mm-hmm. certainly, but you also have very targeted approaches to particular audiences.
I'm curious if you think that there will be, mm-hmm. in the 21st century, if evangelical Christianity will start dealing with the question of homosexuality.
And you've got 15 seconds to answer.
15 seconds or less.
It's starting to do so, I think. Yeah. It's a tough one, I think, for a lot of the folks, but they're beginning to address it.
That's something mainline Protestants have been addressing for many years. Yeah. I'm just wondering.
And painfully so for a lot of folks, but they are coming to terms with mm-hmm. it, I think.
And with that, we come to the absolute end of the available time. My guests have been Randall Balmer, who is the co-author of the recently published book, Religion in American Life, and Manya Brashear. You haven't done your first book yet, have you?
Not yet.
I'm waiting for it.
It'll be a romance novel.
Well, that'd be fine. a Harlequin novel.
Yes, no less.
But one of the characters will be probably a Catholic priest.
Probably. Yeah.
Who resists all temptation. And with that, as I say, we end for tonight. We'll be back again tomorrow night with a close examination of the Arab Spring, which may indeed be turning out to be the Arab winter. We'll find out with a number of very expert guests tomorrow night. Until then, thanks to all for listening, and a cordial good night to all.